You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. France remembers the victims of November 13th. What is the right note to strike on such an occasion? My guests Mary Dajewski and Xenia Wickett will discuss that and the day's other big stories, including semi-renewed hostilities between Ukraine and Russia. Does either side have a clear idea where they're going with this? Next week's climate change conference in Paris. Will there be an agreement? And what if there isn't? And finally,
I feel bad. I feel hopeless. But I will not give up. They are trying to threaten us. They are trying to force us not to write, not to share the secrets, their secrets with the public. But we will continue till the end.
That's the view of one Turkish journalist as two more of her colleagues are arrested. Why is President Recep Tayyip Erdogan so determined to flout the ancient political wisdom of not picking fights with people who buy ink by the barrel? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, columnist with The Independent and The Guardian, and Xenia Wickett, project director at the US program Chatham House. Welcome both. Now, 2 weeks ago tonight, a series of Islamic State attacks across Paris killed 130 people and seriously injured dozens more. Today, France has paused for a national memorial service attended by some survivors of the attacks and families of the victims, as well as President Francois Hollande. A minute's silence was held and the names of the dead were read out. Elsewhere in Paris, shrines still attract bouquets. Across the country, sales of the tricolour are reported to have surged. Mary, first of all, for whose benefit is a memorial like this? We've seen over the last, 14 years now, the Western world trying to figure out a way to memorialise the victims of events like this with a fairly disheartening frequency. Who is it for?
I think especially almost with the French one, it's for the French people and for the nation. It's almost for everybody who wasn't personally involved, because I think there's a sense, like there was a sense in Britain after the London bombings, there's a sense that something needs to be done, that somehow a tribute needs to be paid, there needs to be a sort of national ritual of recognition. And I think that's really what it was for. But of course, the television pictures always also sent a different message, which was, you know, France will be there, and this is a note of defiance as well.
Let me just pick up on that, if I may. I mean, I think Mary's right. This is principally for a domestic audience. But I think if you listen to the rhetoric, Hollande's rhetoric, both today but also over the last week or so, he has sent a very, and actually the weekend after the attacks, he and others in the French political system has sent a very strong message, which is, we will not change our behaviour. We will not be affected by this. You can do what you want and we will push back. This is who we are. And I think that there is also although this is not the audience that I think today's events was directed at, I think there's also a message here that just says, we are strong. You will not bow us down.
Just to pick up on that, Xenia, Hollande's speech did say all those things, but he did also reassert his intention to destroy Islamic State, the organisation that did that. Is that an appropriate tone to take at a memorial?
I don't know whether it's an appropriate tone to take as a moral. It is a very necessary political tone to take. I mean, had he done anything less, he would have been slaughtered on the political scene. I mean, there's an inherent tension, which is politically, leaders have to show that they are going to take strong, firm action immediately. The problem itself requires a longer, more soft power-esque strategy to deal with. Islamic State are not going to be destroyed by short-term military attacks. It is a far longer battle that needs to be done. So you're kind of stuck between, you've seen this in the United States as well, stuck between a short-term political gesture that is absolutely necessary in order to stay politically viable with a need for a much more long-term, slow strategy that isn't politically viable.
Mary, France also, in putting together this service today, had to, I guess, at some level allow or accommodate for the fact that a lot of the people for whom you would think it was for actually didn't feel comfortable with it. Some families of the victims, some victims declined to attend for various reasons. A lot of them suggesting that the government was in some way culpable for the attacks by not having done enough to prevent them. At what level should you accommodate sort of dissent like that?
I think you have to recognise that it exists. I mean, my sense is that it's a minority, it's a well-defined minority, but quite a small minority of French opinion that would say that. That the overwhelming mood, as I understand it, is one, it's one of defiance and one of patriotism. And I think some of the reports about the tricolour being flown, as Hollande sort of requested, today and increasingly. I mean, I find that very interesting because I was based in Paris for 2 years in the late 90s, and the tricolour was really not in evidence except at state occasions where there would be a single flag, you know, a sort of super high quality large French flag. And those are the occasions when it would be flown. And it suffered the fate, almost like the St. George's Cross in Britain, of being hijacked almost by the far right.
There is that thing where middle class, fashionable middle class urban opinion in France associates displays of patriotism with cranky xenophobia.
Exactly. So it'll be very interesting to see whether what sort of happened in Britain that England managed to take back the St. George's Cross as being something that didn't have the overtones of the far right, whether the same can happen in France. And I have to say, I'm not completely hopeful about that, because I think that the far right will, both in the short term and the longer term, be one of the chief beneficiaries of this in French politics.
Senior, what have you made of that patriotic aspect to the response? Because I have to say, I don't recall 10 years ago in London after the July 7th bombings, a sort of a proliferation of Union Jacks by way of response, or still less after the massacre on the beach at Sousse earlier this year.
It's a really interesting question. I mean, I was not here in London during the attacks. I spent 15 years living in the US, where the use of the American flag is all pervasive. You can't walk down a street in Washington, D.C. without having the American flag
be everywhere.
You can't
walk down a street anywhere in the United States.
In the United States without. Well, it's a bit more prevalent on the East Coast than it is on the West Coast. But I mean, it really is the idea of the flag being tied up in the ideology of the United States, the pride in the flag in the United States is something that is all pervasive. And you come back here to Europe, and as Mary says, it just isn't. There isn't that strong sense that whether it's the Union Jack or whether it's the tricolour is something that the mainstream uses. So it's quite interesting, as Mary says, to see that it has been picked up by Hollande as a gesture. I think that I guess I slightly disagree with her in that I think that at least for a period, the right is going to find it quite hard to take that back as a nationalist symbol of kind of resentment of the outside world, if you will. I think that at least for the moment, it has become something that is emblematic of France and holding together. We'll see whether it lasts.
But just a final thought on this, Mary. I guess it's also the question of when does it stop? When do you proceed with life as normal? I mean, I was quite taken this week by the interview with the band that survived the attack at the Bataclan, Eagles of Death Metal, and they said basically they want to go back and finish their show. They want to be the first band to play when the venue reopens. But What is a cut-off point for a period of mourning like this? I mean, I think that would be a really good one, I have to say.
I think it's really, really difficult to tell. And in fact, a sort of a test almost of the caliber of national leadership will be when the signals start coming through that it's normalisation. I think in a way, at the moment, you've got almost a super normalisation because there's so much of a determination to carry on as normal that maybe it will just sort of fade rather gradually back into normal life, and maybe that's for the best.
Okay, well, let's move along now, because this week's news has been so dominated by the threats and recriminations exchanged between Moscow and Ankara that everyone kind of forgot the threats and recriminations being exchanged between Moscow and Kiev, which, while we were all looking the other way, have escalated to a singularly shrill pitch. After electricity to Russian-occupied Crimea was cut by the demolition of four pylons by persons as yet unknown, Russian natural gas supplies to Ukraine were cut, though on whose initiative remains unclear. Ukraine has also banned all Russian air traffic, military or civilian, from its skies. Mary, first of all, the latest update as well is that Russia is now going to restrict its coal supplies to Ukraine. Who does that hurt the most?
It probably hurts Ukraine, because if it is, as it says, self-sufficient for the time being in gas, at least through the winter, that's the reason it gives for having for stopping taking Russian gas as of now, then it's going to need to rely on coal a bit more. And the problem for Ukraine is sort of doubled, because if Russia cuts off sales of coal, then Ukraine, which normally has abundant supplies of its own coal, actually doesn't, because most of it is mined in the east of Ukraine, in those very areas that Kiev doesn't have control of at the moment. So I think it will hurt Ukraine more than it'll hurt Russia.
But if I may, but only over the short term. Over the long term, I mean, we've seen this before. Russia has used energy as a lever, as an influencer, for decades, for at least the last decade. And there's a number of case studies to show this. And every time it does, Europe finds itself working more closely together, creating better gas lines so that gas can go in both directions, so that countries don't get cut off next time Russia decides to stop. So in the short term, I absolutely 100% agree with Mary. In the longer term, this actually harms Russia, because it is yet one more incentive for other European states, including Ukraine and into Western Europe, to actually say, we need to do better at linking up more effectively, linking the grid around Europe so that we can supply from multiple directions and from multiple sources. And that, of course, weakens Russia's ability to do this in the future.
Well, Ukraine has said that it has, I think, at least two boatloads of South African coal en route, and that there's more where that came from. Mary, do you think that's a fair point that Zini has made, that if Russia continues to use energy as a weapon like this, it might just, over the long term, encourage the rest of the world to develop a network which enables them to say to Russia, well, we don't need you anymore?
Well, I think actually it's one of the unsung triumphs of the European Union, the extent to which it has actually pulled together, created an energy policy where it almost didn't have one. And within a very short space of time, you know, gas pipelines, generally you think of them as being very, very long-term projects. Now, in fact, in the last, I would say, 3 years, we've seen an almost complete transformation in the balance of energy power as between Russia and the countries which used to be, and which we still think of, as being dependent on Russian gas. Most of them are actually no longer dependent on Russian gas. That were Russia to cut off their supplies, then there's now a whole network of interconnectors and reverse flows, and it's that which actually is benefiting Ukraine and means that it no longer needs Russian gas to the extent it did before. And so Russia is actually caught two ways, because on the one hand, it's being sort of de facto punished for using the gas weapon in the past. But on the other hand, it's suffering from low prices. So with the contract that it fixed, for instance, with Ukraine at much higher prices, Ukraine is now turning around and saying, not only do we not need to negotiate a lower price because world prices are lower, but we don't actually need the stuff at all.
A question I know of, just to follow that up, Mary, a question I know I've asked you before, but is there any indication yet after, you know, this scenario has been going on now for months and months, years, in fact, at this point, just about, what Russia's actual end game is? Because I'd assumed, actually probably up to a few months ago, that the point we'd reached was what Russia's end game was, which that they own Crimea, whether everyone else wants to recognise that or not. They've established a frozen conflict in the east of Ukraine, which they can turn up or turn down as and when it suits them. Is there anything else they still want?
Well, I think that, I mean, I've taken a rather non-consensus view of Russia's objectives in Ukraine. And I actually stick by that view. I think that Crimea is actually, you know, as we would say from our side, lost. Russia is not going to reverse its annexation of Crimea. But I think if you look at the rest of Ukraine, my view is that Russia is actually prepared to recognize Ukraine, and indeed has always been prepared to recognize Ukraine as a sovereign, independent state, and that if the Minsk agreement is fulfilled clause by clause on both sides, then the border between Ukraine and Russia in the east will actually be demarcated. It will be closed with recognized crossing points, and Ukraine will be, minus Crimea, yes, and that's not a good thing, but minus Crimea, Ukraine will be a self-standing, independent country without, you know, all this business of Russia wanting a frozen conflict, Russia wanting to meddle and make Ukraine unsustainable. I actually don't think that's what Russia wants. I think Russia wants a secure, it wants its own borders, its own post-Soviet borders to be secure, and it saw them threatened by chaos in Ukraine.
I guess I agree with everything Mary's just said except for the last clause, which is to say, and it saw them threatened by chaos in Ukraine. I think that Russia does want strong borders. It does want an independent Ukraine. It certainly does not want to be responsible for Ukraine. It's having enough trouble being responsible from the Crimea, which is a resource sink as opposed to a resource additive, if you will. But Russia also wants an unstable Ukraine, an independent Ukraine, but it wants essentially a buffer zone in Ukraine. The idea that NATO and the EU, hypothetically speaking, would literally be sitting on its borders is a frightening one to Russia.
Why, though? Because NATO and the EU are sitting on its borders in the Baltic states, in Poland.
Because essentially it means that Russia is being contained. Russia is being pressurized. I mean, you know, if you look, let's
other country thinks like that. You know, Norway doesn't worry that it's being contained by having Finland and Sweden.
But Norway hasn't actually been fighting the Cold War against Europe for however long.
True enough.
You know, but if you look, let me vault to Asia, which I know a little bit better. You know, you've got India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, and they're all kind of playing proxy wars, and Iran with one another, because the Pakistanis are terrified that India's making nice with the Iranians, because then you'd have threats on two borders. People don't like to be surrounded by what they perceive to be threats to their country. In the case of Russia, that's an ideological threat to the country. Russia wants that buffer zone. That buffer zone currently is Ukraine. If Ukraine becomes an independent, strong state that follows the morals, ideology, systems of the West, that is something that makes Russia nervous.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Xenia Wickett and Mary Dejewski. Coming up next, can world leaders who can't agree on much else at least agree to maintain the planet in a state worth fighting over? And is there a limit to how strange and repressive Erdogan's Turkey can get?
Each week on The Foreign Desk, we take a look at a single story, we find two or three great guests, and then we try to work out what's going on. It might be the story that's dominating the news that week.
The main thing they wanted to do was to stop, to get rid of Obama. How are you going to negotiate with that?
It might be something we think everyone else is ignoring.
Children, elderly, it doesn't matter. Anybody that is leaving the country is going to be shot.
Either way, the format's the same. Guests who know their stuff, talking knowledgeably, so that you and me end up knowing a little bit more than we did before. That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time and available at any time on monocle.com.
Uh, And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Mary Dejewski and Xenia Wickett. Now, Paris will be in the news again starting next week, although mercifully not in the headlines, but in the boring but important slot about 9 minutes into the bulletin or on about page 7 of any given newspaper. The hook will be COP21, otherwise known as the United Nations Climate Change Conference. All 11 days of it. Mary, you're not going, are you?
I am not going, no. And I have to say that I've tended to keep climate change as one remove from my chief interests, which is probably a dreadful admission to make. But I think there are plenty of people for whom it is such a preoccupation that they are so concerned about it that I'm quite content actually to leave it to them.
I think that's perfectly sensible. Because I imagine for people who write regularly about climate change, their inboxes, it would be worse than writing about the Middle East or cycling. I would think. Xenia, this is obviously climate. I mean, it's obviously terrifically important. Obviously it is. But I think for journalists, there's the same problem that the politicians have, that this is a huge long-term, generations away problem. Are they likely to knock it over in 11 days in Paris, do we think?
They're unlikely to knock it over. I mean, this is the same problem that we were talking about earlier about the situation in Paris today. There are short-term things that need to be done. The impact is going to be long-term, so any politician who does them now isn't going to gain the benefit of seeing the impact over the long-term. And I mean, so many problems have a short-term, long-term disparity that makes them very, very hard from a policy perspective to answer. What we're looking for in Paris, you know, the levels of decrease, if you will, the treaty obligations have already been decided. What Paris is trying to decide is how to enforce those treaty obligations. We already, there was a good success about a month or so ago where everybody was feeling very upbeat about Paris because the US and China and a number of other countries came forward and said, this is what we are committing to. And then India rather burst the bubble by saying, we're not going to commit to anything meaningful. So and we do not want there to be a strong statement coming out of Paris, coming out of COP21 that mandates verification. So it's going to be interesting to see how we can square that particular circle. But as you pointed out, this is arguably one of the most important challenges that we, the world, face today. And yet it is so hard to grasp hold of and to do anything meaningful or to talk about it in a meaningful and brief way that it's not getting the attention it deserves, perhaps.
And it's getting increasingly hard to get people to care about it. A recent poll in 20 sample countries, in 2009, it found 63% of people were very concerned about climate change. This year, it found just under 50%. Mary, why has... Because, I mean, I think if we can put to one side all the kind of cranky Donald Trump variety climate change isn't happening stuff, because the scientific consensus is fairly ironclad. So why is it that politicians have failed to engage, or at least are failing to engage the general public in the way they appear to have been able to 10 years ago on this?
Well, I think I'd probably go back to something that Xenia was talking about, that it's one of those long-term problems. And I think that when the tsunami happened, then people looked at that and they said, well, maybe that is, in a way, the shape of the future. That alarm came to the fore and there were those pictures of water, huge numbers of people killed, huge amount of land inundated. And I think then there was a sort of concern triggered. But there hasn't been anything like that since. There've been earthquakes, there've been natural disasters, there've been all sorts of other things have been happening, but nothing which immediately says to the great global public, this is the danger of climate change and we've got to do something now. I think they've just found a lot more urgent things to think about.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we'll return to Turkey, which picked this week of all weeks to attempt to reinvigorate its quest for membership membership of the EU. Not for the first time, however, Turkey's also given every impression of being a country which has neglected to take even the most cursory skim of the entry requirements. Already one of the world's most hostile media environments, it became even more so with the arrests of two more prominent journalists, Cumhuriyet editor-in-chief Can Dündar and the same newspaper's Ankara bureau chief Erdem Gül. Zinia, first of all, I shouldn't be laughing because it's clearly serious. Both have been charged with espionage. They face life imprisonment. Just for fun, I guess I'll ask the question, is there any way at all this isn't as mad as it sounds?
It depends on how you define mad, really. I mean, the sad statement is that the arrest of journalists, the shutting down of journalists, the shutting down of freedom of speech is happening around the world. This is not a phenomenon that is restricted to Turkey.
Indeed not. It is especially bad in Turkey. 149th out of 180 countries.
Exactly. It's particularly bad of Turkey. But we can list the number of countries where the tamp down, if you will, on journalists is getting worse rather than better. So, you know, is it this particular case? It was talking about talking about the Turkish intelligence services transporting weapons to Syrian militias, opposition parties. Back in January of 2014, it was only publicized in May of this year, so they waited 14, 15 months before they publicized it. And now in November, they're arresting them. You have to ask the question, isn't this a little overcome by events? I mean, isn't this a little old story? Why is this still such a threat?
Or you come to a different conclusion and you say, this is one of these things that's been sort of stored up on the back burner mm-hmm. for an occasion yes. when you want to send certain signals, whether about that particular story or about those particular journalists or about free speech in general in Turkey. So well, I think the timing is probably significant.
No, I think it's exactly that, because the two reporters have also been accused of supporting the Fethullah Gulen movement. And that's basically Turkish for round up the usual suspects, isn't it?
Yes. And of course, you know, we're looking, it could hardly have come at a worse time from almost any perspective, because as you say, you know, Turkey has, as it were, restarted its application to join the EU as a sort of bargaining point for all the pressure that it's getting from the European Union to try and clamp down on free passage of refugees and would-be migrants to the European Union. And it's also, we've had the shooting down this week of the Russian fighter by the Turkish Air Force, which has made relations with Russia either particularly tense and nearly non-existent. So Turkey could really do without sending out another message of sort of intolerance and aggressiveness.
Zinia, as you point out, this story's been doing the rounds for a while. Erdogan, you would think, must be aware. He may not be aware that it's called the Streisand effect, but he's presumably aware of the phenomenon whereby you draw more attention to something by trying to suppress it than attention would be paid to it if you just ignored it. But the detail which leapt out at me was he has also filed a personal lawsuit under his own name against the newspaper. He's the president of the country. I'm going to ask this as delicately as I possibly can. Is he still entirely with us, do we think?
Again, depends on definition, doesn't it? I'm using all my diplomatic skills to be diplomatic. It does make one concerned, frankly, because, you know, as Mary and you both point out, if you look at the timing of this, if you look at the way it was done, it doesn't look like an entirely rational decision. You know, again, going to South Asia, you look at some of the actions of then Pakistani President Musharraf just before he was essentially deposed or effectively voted out. He was doing things like this because he had a circle around him that didn't tell him that this wasn't a smart thing to do. And so you do have to ask yourself, you know, that for Erdogan has effectively been in power for over a decade now. Turkey has come a long way during that time. But you do have to ask yourself whether over the last couple of years, Erdogan has surrounded himself by yes men and he's getting decent advice.
It's a strange thing for somebody to do, because it suggests that they're in a weak position and they want somehow to send a signal that they're not. Erdogan has just won an election.
Exactly.
We will have to leave it there. Mary Dijewski and Xenia Wickett, thanks both very much for joining us. That's all for today's show. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Piers Ellison. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Josh Fennett has music with From Monocle's International Playlist. Marcus Hippie follows at 1900 with The Menu. Emma Nelson and Paul Osborne are in at 2200 with The Daily. Midori House returns on Monday. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Have a good weekend. Thanks for listening.